Good day, this is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you from Montreal, Canada for Reason to Resist on July 17th, 2026. In recent months, Israel has been rocked by a massive ritual child sexual abuse scandal. The scandal involves the ritual sexual abuse and torture of children as young as 3 years. The victims were abused and tormented in many of these cases by members of their own family. And up on the screen, I'm showing you the headline from an article published in May of this year by the investigative news outlet Shomerim, the Center for Media and Democracy in Israel. According to Inbal Brenner, who was quoted in this article, and he is the chairperson of the Israeli Society for Sexual Trauma Treatment and Prevention, the perpetrators of these heinous crimes, quote, in quite a few cases, were high-status community members. They either held respected religious or spiritual authority, like a rabbi, or occupied other influential prominent positions. And elsewhere in this article, another mental health expert in Israel is quoted as saying that at least one of the perpetrators was a judge, and numerous of them were doctors. I repeat, medical doctors. Now, if your only source of information about world events was the Western corporate media, then almost certainly you would know nothing about this scandal, because the Western corporate media predictably have avoided the scandal like the plague. One of the few Western journalists, or at least someone who originally hails from the West, who has covered this astonishing scandal is joining us here today, and she's none other than our wonderful independent journalist, Vanessa Bealey, who is coming to us today from Beirut, Lebanon. Vanessa, I've long been an admirer of your work. I know many people in our audience have as well. If I'm not mistaken, this is the first time we've had you on this program, or were you on once before?
No, I think it is the first time. I know that we were on together on our dear friend BetBeat with Karim. But no, it's the first time I've been on, so thank you. I'm coming on for a very dark and sinister topic.
Indeed, and it is not, I want to alert our audience, the only topic we're going to cover today. Vanessa has also a wealth of knowledge about Syria. I'm going to ask her in the second half of this interview about some important recent developments in Syria, particularly as it pertains to the war of aggression on Iran. But first, let's turn to this really sordid story. And I want to caution people in advance that you may hear things that will be very disturbing. But we think it's important that the breadth and horror of this scandal be exposed, particularly to Western audiences who know so little about it. So before we begin, I just want to remind people, Vanessa, if they find this video to be informative, please like and share it. And if you're not already a subscriber to Reason to Resist, we warmly encourage you to become one. Please help us to expand the reach of our on-the-ground, unapologetic resistance journalism. So, because you might find it difficult to believe what we're about to hear, I am going to include in the description to this video a link to that Shomerim investigative report. And in addition, I'm going to provide a link to an article that Vanessa authored, and it's available on her Substack in May of this year. We're going to talk a little bit about that article in a few moments' time, but you can, if you want to see that this isn't simply, as many people who are favorably disposed towards Israel might want you to believe, conspiracy theory, it is coming from Israeli authorities and the corporate media in Israel after many years of suppression, and you can, we're going to help you to verify that for yourself if you so wish. Now, with that, Vanessa, let's begin. First, could you please talk to us about the nature of the ritual abuse and the people who typically were involved in committing these crimes against very young children?
Yeah, well, first of all, just a few statistics. And I know statistics are always a little bit shaky. People can always find a counter to whatever statistics we put out publicly. But I have looked into them, and I think I'm pretty safe in saying that the incident of sexual abuse against underage minors in Israel is around 20% for boys and girls. Now, the percentage of abuse across a much wider range, so including domestic violence and the sexual abuse and other forms of psychological abuse, is 52%, which is pretty huge. And I also looked, just as a comparison, at the UK, which of course is a much bigger population. There it's around 5% of sexual, known sexual abuse against minors. But what people really need to grasp in this, while that is a relatively high percentage of Israeli minors, in other words, children that are sexually abused, not only through the ultra-Orthodox communities, which is what we're largely talking about in these Knesset inquiries that have literally only just surfaced, although these crimes have been going on for apparently decades, but only 5% of those crimes are reported, and a tiny, tiny percentage are actually followed through. So what this means is that all elements of society in Israel are responsible for covering it up, and that includes the police. And that is, this is actually recorded in a prior investigation done by another Israeli media outlet, Israel Hayom, and I've written about that investigation, where they said the police were actually responsible for not following up on these cases of ritual abuse. And that is what it comes down to. So 63% of these crimes are committed by the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox communities. And remember that they also span the United States. There have also been multiple cases in Brooklyn and New York, which is the second largest population of ultra-Orthodox Haredi Jews after Israel. So 63% of that 20% are crimes committed by this community, 5% reported. And what they include, and this is where it kind of gets horrifying. So the Haredi community is known for basically growing exponentially. Most families have around 6 children. And in the next 30 years, they're expected to make up around 40% of the Jewish Israeli population. So that just gives you an indication of how big this sector of Israeli Jews actually is within Israel itself, right? Now, what we're talking here is, as you mentioned, is ritual abuse, ceremonial abuse of children as young as 3, as you said. And it can be conducted by doctors, by rabbis, by family members. I mean, you had the case of, I need to check her name because I always forget it, Shoshana Struck, who was the daughter of Orit Struck, the far-right National Missions Minister, who mysteriously died, of course, in March of this year, having basically released information about her own childhood abuse and the fact that her father was even involved in sex trafficking herself. Many of these testimonies, which are horrifying, they're very disturbing. I mean, you are talking mass rape. You're talking teenage boys who go through the ceremony of raping a female child as a passage, as a rite of passage into adulthood within these communities. Children are threatened that if they don't submit to whatever abuse they are intended to be exploited with, then other members of their family will be taken in their place. So there's a huge degree of kind of blackmail, gaslighting, psychological pressure on these children to take part in these ceremonies, which can sometimes include up to 15, 20 men, many of them members of the family. And the ceremony itself is usually led by a rabbi. The men can often be dressed in these ceremonial robes. There are cases of the use of pentagrams, red pentagrams, and I actually looked into that. That isn't a Judaic symbol. that's normally considered a symbol of occultism or Satanism.
Now, there's plenty of evidence, I understand, that these children were tortured, not just raped, but, for example, the strangulation, starvation. Could you talk to us about that? What do we know about the forms of torture that were applied to these children and how frequent that was?
Yeah, I mean, it was very frequent. In a sense, it was a way of softening, of psychologically humiliating and putting the child in a state of mind where they would accept these ritual abuses. For example, in the Israel Hayom report, there was a case where a child was consistently held underwater, and she was then told, see, you've been brought back to life, when they released her from being held underwater. And the bringing back to life means that you should submit to what abuse we are going to carry out against you. Really, the cases of physical abuse also against children. There was another article in Haaretz a few years ago talking about in the Haredi schools where teachers would regularly torture and abuse children, even in the class, not necessarily sexually abuse them, but they would be beaten, they would be psychologically tortured, humiliated in front of their classmates, and so on. Mm-hmm. But the level, many of the children that went through sexual abuse in these ceremonies were drugged, were given drugs. And I think the greatest abuse, Dimitri, is the fear of speaking out. If we think that only 5% of these cases have come to light, that for me is abuse in itself, because that means there are 95% of other cases that are simply not being exposed, where the perpetrators are continuing to abuse children. And going back to, I think it was 2020, there was an article in Jerusalem Post. Again, this is all in Israeli media. This isn't some kind of conspiracy theory that Dimitri and I are making up. Back in 2020, Jerusalem Post reported on something like 100,000 or tens of thousands of pedophiles were operating inside Israel. In Haaretz 2022, 100 rabbis, teachers, all known for their pedophile crimes, had been given refuge in Israel. And that's a really important point. Israel is effectively a haven for pedophiles. So if there are known cases, again, that I've documented, where child abusers, for example, in the United States, have converted to Judaism and then been given refuge in Israel. And this isn't only something which is happening inside the Haredi communities. It's something that is also happening outside. Even more recently, since October the 7th, the refugees, the colonialist refugees from the north of the occupied territories, who came to refugee hotels in areas of the occupied territories, themselves faced sexual abuse and potential trafficking of minors and so on. So it's a societal rot within Israel, which again, then it's perpetrated against Palestinians on a far more regular basis, of course.
And that's what I wanted to raise next. This is the headline of your excellent article from May 31st of this year. Ritual child abuse and rape is a societal norm in Israel, according to latest investigation by Zionist media outlet. And you begin this article talking about an absolutely mind-bogglingly sadistic crime committed by Israeli soldiers, I believe it was, against a Palestinian child and his father. Can you talk to us about that particular incident and the connection between this ritual abuse network that exists in Israel and the treatment of Palestinian children?
Well, I mean, I think people are fully aware of the extent of rape of Palestinian prisoners now, particularly in Sde Tayman, but I mean, it's endemic across all of the Israeli prisons and detention centers. This was a case in Gaza where the father I'd basically left his house and was trying to find food and water for the family. And he was stopped at a checkpoint. He'd taken his baby boy with him. He was stopped at a checkpoint and he himself was stripped down to his underwear, which of course we've seen multiple times. The Zionist forces forced Palestinians to strip and then line them up naked next to each other. And in order to make him basically confess that he was a part of Hamas or that he had conducted any kind of military operation against the Zionists occupying Gaza, they put out cigarettes on his child in front of him. And they also drove a nail into the child's body in front of him.
Wow. And presumably, Vanessa, there were no condemnations from Western governments you're aware of this demonic crime?
No, I mean, you know, historically, Dmitry, what do they always, even the UN, I mean, what is the result? Israel is going to investigate its own crimes. Right. This is almost always the result we end up with. And even the fact, what I find very disturbing is that now expose of these crimes is reaching the Knesset, right? Mm-hmm. But what does that actually mean to me? That means that it has reached a saturation level where they can no longer ignore it. They can no longer pretend it's not happening. So for how many years has this been ongoing? For how many years have children been abused in this way? And I'm certainly not going to let Zionists off the hook in any way, shape, or form. But the abused very often become abusers. And if these children are growing up in an environment where abuse of minors is prevalent, then we see it even in the IOF. I mean, it's not psychologically correct or normal for soldiers to start putting on women's underwear or to start abusing children's toys in the way that they do, or even the abuse that was conducted against the global Sumud flotilla participants, for example, which was across the board, sexual abuse, harassment, humiliation.
Now, in your article of May 31st, you also talked about an important admission that was made by a council in Israel's religious Zionist settler sector. This was the Gush Etzion Regional Council in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Could you tell us a little bit about what they fessed up to, and are you aware of any others?
Blank. I've written so much about it all. Just remind me what they did fess up to.
I'll share it with our audience and you can chime in if you have any information you want to offer by way of elaboration. So according to your article, the Gush Etzion Regional Council, and this was reported, I believe, by Israel Hayom, or perhaps it was the Cannes News Network, publicly admitted that ritualistic sexual abuse of children occurred within its communities. And it was a confession that marks the first time a governing body in Israel's religious Zionist settler sector broke ranks with years of denial. Yes, it was the Khan 11.
Right. Network. Yeah.
So does that ring a bell?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, all of these basically since about 2025, it's been coming to the surface. And there have, of course, also been cases in Brooklyn. That are also very much underreported by Western media, even though it's in New York itself. And of course, the response from Israelis is always, this is blood libel, you know, or anti-Semitism. This is, you're not allowed to talk about it in the West, basically. And the fact that there is an admission, I don't know. I, as I've said, I just find it sort of creepy that there's suddenly an omission now when this has clearly been ongoing for decades. And if you look at how the Haredi community itself operates, it's a very closed community, very similar to a cult. It has its own education facilities where boys and girls are segregated, by the way. And that is one of their objections to joining the IOF, is that most of the brigades are not segregated. So there is apparently a special Haredi brigade. I think there's about 1,800 Haredi fighting for the IOF, but of course there are protests against conscription of the Haredi and the Hasidi, which is a subsect of the Haredi ultra, as they're known, the ultra-Orthodox Jews. So the very fact that it's such a closed community is what has protected it from scrutiny, basically, both in Israel and externally in New York. And I think that's the scary part for me, is that we just don't know to what extent it is absolutely endemic and systemic. And when you look at what is happening as regards sexual abuse of Palestinian prisoners, both men and women and children, I mean, across the board, right? And total sexual degradation, humiliation, internal damage to these people that are raped in all manner of ways, including with dogs. And people look at me as if I'm insane when I talk about that. But, you know, the Americans have used such measures also, particularly in Iraq, against prisoners there. Mm-hmm. It isn't actually a new thing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these prisoners are really reduced down to, in their minds, the lowest form of life, where any kind of punishment or humiliation or sexual abuse can be conducted against them, it does make you wonder where this comes from.
But I just want to be clear, I mean, and please correct me if I'm wrong about this. My understanding is that although these practices may be present, these ritual sexual abuse practices, to a disproportionate degree in the Haredi community, this is not by no means confined in Israel to the Haredi, no. Haredi community. That there's a not broad sure. range of perpetrators coming from across Israeli society, apparently.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, covering this story, Vanessa, obviously would be very difficult for any person of conscience like yourself, and I really appreciate that you've done that and helped to enlighten us about these horrific acts. I want to turn now to the question of Syria. I know you've spent a lot of time there. You have many connections inside Syrian society, I assume. And so you're able to provide us some insights. A few of us have. And I want to talk to you in particular about something that Donald Trump said last month about, al-Jolani, the Syrian dictator, coming to the rescue of Israel in Lebanon. Here is what the Donald had to say.
Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long and too many people are being killed. And you don't have to knock down an apartment house every time you're looking for somebody, because there are a lot of people in those apartment houses and they're not all Hezbollah, that I can tell you. And I suggested to Israel to let Syria take care of Hezbollah. Because to be honest with you, I think they'd do a better job of doing it. Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long.
Now, that little clip is remarkable on a variety of fronts. And I invite you to comment on any aspect of it that you think is notable. But the part that I want to focus on is the invitation to al-Jolani to send his terrorist mercenaries into Lebanon. Now, after this little doozy from Donald Trump, al-Jolani did tell the media that his country was not interested in intervening in Lebanon. And there has been some more recent developments. I think al-Jolani was seated beside Trump in a recent press conference where Trump was again making noises about Syrian mercenaries, terrorists intervening in Lebanon. And in that instance, it didn't seem, as I recall, that al-Jolani really put up any kind of, expressed any kind of objection to that idea. So the bottom line, what is it here, Vanessa, based on the information available to you, what do you think the intentions of al-Jolani are?
Yeah, I mean, I have actually written two articles about this, and I'm about to write a third one as a kind of catch up, because of course the operational tactics are changing depending on the situation on the ground. But Trump also, after the NATO summit, he made a very clear response to a journalist that asked him if Jelani had committed to anything, and according to Trump, yes, he did. Now, I'd written a couple of articles prior to the NATO summit where I was talking about the fact that, again, there are Ukrainian forces on the ground inside Syria. And they had previously in 2023 been on the ground in Idlib, helping Jelani prepare for the operations of November, December 2024, when Syria finally fell after 14 years of resisting. And so the Ukrainians back then were providing drone technology and surveillance and radar and so on, and also training for Jelani's militias in return for some of the militias to go and fight with Ukraine against Russia. Now, according to intelligence that I've received from my very good sources, Ukrainians are back on the ground, particularly in the coastal area to the north of the border, the northern border with Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Jelani has built up a strike force of around 70,000, which include factions that come under the influence of Turkey. So that's also why, in my opinion, Trump has released the F-35s to Turkey. The Israeli ambassador to the US, Michael Leiter, I think his name is, was basically backing off on the kind of Israeli condemnation of supplying F-35s to Turkey, and kind of saying, well, you know, if the Americans need to do this for strategic reasons, then we'll accept it. And he also butted up Erdogan in the sense of kind of bigging him up as being his partner in basically bringing Jelani to power in Syria. There was a lot of sweet talking of Erdogan at the NATO summit from Trump. And I think this is partly to ensure that Turkish proxies are prepared to take part in whatever operation Jelani has agreed to, but also perhaps to give the green light for Turkey's influence in the north of Lebanon, which has always been part of the Turkish Mavi Vatan doctrine, which is to control the maritime corridors of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Aegean Sea, and the Black Sea. And so Turkey has been, according to my sources, they've been holding off, waiting for these assurances from Trump, which I believe they received at the NATO summit. At the same time, of course, the terrorist designation for Syria was removed. A number of other sanctions were removed, which I think was the sweetener, the political sweetener for Jelani and his so-called HTS government, which, of course, is nothing more than a rebranded al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we are seeing in the last few days, I'll just mention the memorandum of understanding also between elements within the Lebanese government that are aligned with Washington and Tel Aviv, who have tried to sideline the Iranian pressure on Israel to withdraw from pretty much all the region where they are unlawfully occupying territory in Lebanon and Syria, of course, in Palestine. With this MOU, there's a very important section where basically they are talking about the state having control of the defense of Lebanon, and any other non-state actor that is defending the country is doing so, I'm paraphrasing, is doing so without the express permission of the state. So therefore they become unlawful. Now, Jelani is making statements to the extent where he's saying, we're not going to intervene, but I will defend the territorial integrity of Lebanon and the state institutions of Lebanon. So see where I'm going with this. So that they're framing it in the MOU as Hezbollah being outside the state, being a proxy of Iran, And Jalani's rhetoric is very much, I will protect the state institutions in Lebanon. So what does that mean, according to the language of the MOU? He can intervene to defend the Lebanese state against Hezbollah, right? So that's how they're framing it. So it's not an invasion as such. Now, on the other hand, what Israel wants to achieve out of this is that much of the Hezbollah weapons manufacturing, storage, missile storage, etc., is in the mountainous area, deep underground. I think you've been to the Bekaa region, as have I. And that entire range of mountains on the eastern border between Lebanon and Syria is where Hezbollah basically stores the majority of its weapons and where they also manufacture weapons. So Israel, just as they did in Syria, they need people on the ground to secure these areas so they can destroy them, because they can't really destroy them from the air because they're so deep underground. And they had the same problem in Syria prior to Jalani being brought to power by the entire Zionist Persian Gulf State alliance. And so we don't yet have a clear picture of what is going to happen. But in the last couple of days, there's been a ramping up of rhetoric. Both Iran and Iraq, the resistance in Iraq, have threatened to intervene should Jalani lead any kind of military attack against Lebanon or against the resistance in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, Iran bombed Al-Tanf, which was formerly the American base in Syria on the border with Jordan and Syria. Jalani has been desperately having talks with the government in Iraq to try and increase border security with Iraq, because he knows if he takes a step towards Lebanon, then he's going to be attacked from the rear by the Iraqi resistance. But there's also around 70,000 Syrian Arab Army soldiers who left the country in December 2024 and who are now in Iraq. There's around 30,000 also here in Lebanon. I was talking to a former Syrian military commander the day before yesterday. His theory is Jalani will try and enter northern Lebanon, where he has some sympathy among some of the Sunni communities there. So they will effectively open the door to him, which they've already been doing in Tripoli and in Tarablus in the north, right on the border with Syria. And from there, they'll advance from the north and they'll try to cut roads off, so connecting the north with the central areas and the south. And that is a more likely. I can't personally see him leading a direct military attack. I think that is going to be suicidal for him. From both ends, from the Iraqi side and also from the Hezbollah Syrian Arab Army side here in Lebanon, although he has been moving positions forward in the Homs area.
What's your best estimate, Vanessa, of the number of men under arms in this terrorist entity?
According to sources, around 70,000. So it's not a small force. It's a strike force, and they've established radar and surveillance systems along the border also, including, of course, the British watchtowers, which were installed about 3 years ago that I reported on, that are not for gathering information on ISIS. They're effectively for spying on the resistance inside Lebanon. And also, Turkey supplied air defense radar, HTRS-100, that's been reported in Israeli media, to Damascus civilian airport, which has the capability to surveil pretty much all of Lebanon. So they also have other equipment. Turkish military is also now entering. There were warships that arrived at the Latakia naval base, I think, 2 days ago. And there are Turkish military putting up Turkish flags in the Latakia mountain area also in the last 48 hours.
And what's your best estimate of the number of combat-capable fighters who remain in the resistance in Lebanon? Do you have any sense of that figure?
There's a lot of figures kind of floating around. You probably know those as well, that overall there's about 100,000. But what I've also been hearing is that there are numerous supporters of the resistance coming in from regional countries who are being told to stand down at the moment because they're not needed. So that's reinforcements. You also have, as I said, the former Syrian Arab Army, who, as far as I know, are located, the majority of them, in the Bekaa area, so on that eastern border. And so there is potential for them also to be mobilized to deal with any threat from Jelani. Yesterday also, it's kind of the start of the narrative building. Jelani accused Hezbollah of operating inside Syria, and he also made a big deal of stopping weapons that were allegedly being sent to Hezbollah. Now, why I'm smiling at this is because weapons have been coming in through Syria. Why? Because not because Jelani is some kind of, you know, white hat in all of this, but because Syria is controlled by mercenaries now. It's controlled by Takfiri mercenaries who will do anything for money. And so therefore, the resistance in Lebanon has been benefiting from that to still bring weapons in through Syria, through the borders, because they're just paying to smuggle them in. So it's nothing new. But the fact that this narrative was being blown out of all proportion yesterday means that they're starting to build a narrative and a pretext for some kind of operation against Hezbollah.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, and I put this up on the screen as you were speaking, this is a report from Geopolitics Prime, which itself is a summary of a Press TV report that the Operation Nasser, this is one of the operations currently being carried out by the Iranian military against U.S. forces in the region. They sent an 11th wave, took out radar systems and multiple special ops helicopters, inflicting heavy casualties, they say, on U.S. forces in this area, Al-Tanf, which is near the border with Iraq in Syria. And my understanding is that this is the first time that Iran has struck Syrian territory since the Ramadan War began on February 28th. Is that at least publicly acknowledged that it struck Syrian territory? Is that your understanding as well, Vanessa?
Yeah, I don't think actually they... I'm trying to think. I don't think they've ever struck. Well, they've certainly not struck Syrian territory since Jelani was brought to power, that I'm aware of. There have been reports of attacks from inside Iraq at various points, but not from Iran. This is the first time that we've seen a direct attack. The Al-Tanf base, I mean, what is kind of interesting is that the US under Trump actually reported that they had withdrawn from all Syrian bases. But my understanding, again, is that they have been building up again in Damascus countryside in the central Syria area around Palmyra to the east of Homs. And it appears that they're building up again in Al-Tanf, because Al-Tanf kind of straddles Jordan and Syria. So that's another point. I don't know if they hit the Syrian part of Al-Tanf or they hit the Jordan part of Al-Tanf. That's not 100% clear. But the fact that they have targeted that entire area, which still seems to retain radar systems, is very interesting. And they've been hitting Jordan quite hard as well.
The Press TV report does appear to say it was Syrian territory, whether that's accurate or not, we can't be sure. But in any case, it seems to me, Vanessa, that this attack served a double purpose. The one was to retaliate for the ongoing aggression against the Iran, and quite possibly to send a message to Al-Jolani that that the Iranians are fully prepared, if he should engage in an aggression against the Lebanese resistance, to target his forces in Syria. So if I were him, and thank God I'm not, I would be very concerned about what this attack on Al-Tanf is intended to communicate. And even if you just put this aside, the sort of overall landscape that you've drawn for us very capably, this sounds to me like a perilous situation for al-Jilani. He's 70,000 men, and he doesn't really have a firm grip on all Syrian territory. These people, as you mentioned, are mercenaries. So how deep is their loyalty to this criminal in Damascus, really, at the end of the day? So they could end up having, if you'll excuse my French, their asses handed to them by resistance forces both in Iraq and Lebanon, and maybe even some elements of the Syrian population would take the opportunity to engage in armed resistance against al-Jilani's mercenaries. In any case, thank you very much for that description. This is obviously something we need to follow very carefully. If in fact the al-Jilani's mercenaries move on Lebanon, I think we're going to see the region go up in flames even to a greater degree than we have until now. One other thing I just also wanted to point out here, Vanessa, is you were talking about the framework agreement between Lebanon and the Israeli government. This provision caught my eye. It was Article 4. Mm-hmm. And I talked about it when they first published this thing. It says, last sentence, the government of Lebanon herewith requests the support of international and particularly Arab partners under the leadership of the United States to achieve the outcome
of, exactly,
you know, disarming resistance groups and achieving a monopoly over the use of force in Lebanon. So that to me was a not so subtle call to people like al-Jilani to come to the aid of these.
And I mean, you've seen visits by Nawaf Salam. You've seen Assad al-Shaybani, the foreign minister, who was also one of the founders of al-Qaeda in Syria, to the north in particular, where, of course, he was greeted, uproariously by the Takfiri elements that are in the north of Lebanon. So, yeah, this is a collusion between President al-Nawaf Salam, the prime minister, and Jilani, and Trump, and Israel, of course, and Saudi Arabia also.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Vanessa. It's been a pleasure talking to you today, and I hope you'll come back on our program soon so we can continue the conversation.
Sure, I'd love to. Thanks, Dimitri, and welcome back.
Thank you very much. And we're signing off today, July 17th, from Montreal and Beirut.